welcome to a Bow Valley Christian Church podcast. You are listening to Cal Haltgren share a message titled, Here's to Those Who See the Unseen, from the series titled, These Three Remain. This message was broadcasted live January 29th, 2023.
Now, if you've known me for a while, you probably know that I am a big Apple fan. Apple Macintosh, I've been a big fan of them since 1978 when we got our first Apple computer. I'm also a big fan of their advertising, especially around the turn of the century. One of their greatest ads was titled, Think Different. Now, the apparent error in grammar was actually intentional. Different to be understood as in, like, think victory. They wanted to emphasize the fact that different was a noun. Now, this phrase not only worked for Apple, gaining them immediate attention, both good and bad, mostly good, it redefined the whole company and also what the company could be. Today, they're one of the largest companies in the world. The writer for that ad script said, referring to the ad, it got an audience that was once thought of Apple as kind of semi-cool, but kind of semi-stupid. And then to suddenly think about the brand in a whole new way. And so this is the script. Originally said by Richard Dreyfuss, I will not match his rhetoric, but this is what it said. Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify them, or vilify them. But the only thing you can't do is ignore them, because they change things. They push the human race forward, and while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see them as genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think that they can change the world are the ones that do. The ad scrolls through people like Albert Einstein, as you saw there, Bob Dylan, Martin Luther King Jr., Richard Branson, John Lennon, Thomas Edison, Muhammad Ali, Ted Turner, Mahatma Gandhi, Amelia Earhart, Alfred Hitchcock, John Henson with Kermit the Frog, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Pablo Picasso. Why do I mention all this? I bet that if you knew of any of these people personally, you would probably see them as a bit of a misfit, crazy, troublemakers. But on this side of history, we find them also rather inspiring, do we not? They saw the world not as most. They saw it with different eyes. Rob Siltanen, who wrote that script, or wrote the core of it, could just as easily have been writing the intro to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 gives us this list, what we often call the heroes of the faith. Its own list of misfits, of rebels, of uncommon visionaries. These heroes. They are called heroes because they saw the world as it really is. Most of us just see just beyond our nose, or we see the world as what we want it to see. But these men and with that, men and women, because some of them were listed, but not by name, but by description, they saw the world with the curtains drawn back. We call that faith. Seeing the unseen. They saw it by trusting in the only thing that was worth trusting in, our Creator God. In Hebrews 11, this is the list. Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and others unnamed, but their life described. There's something about these people who have their faith that makes them stand out different, even odd. Chuck Swindoll, in talking about faith, made this interesting point. He said, your faith ought to get you into trouble sometimes. If everyone thinks that you're nuts, you probably are. It's okay if some think you're nuts. You're probably in trouble, though, if no one thinks you're nuts. We're in a year-long series looking at these three foundational words of the Christian life: faith, hope, and love. Today's message takes us to Hebrews chapter 11. Steve introduced this chapter last week, outlining kind of the foundational aspects of faith. And then this week, today, we look at the first two people in this hero list, Abel and Enoch. Two people's life's end could be of no different than each other. One murdered by his brother, the other who never tasted death at all. Just last week, elders and the staff had gathered and we were doing some trivia. And there was a math question, and it was, what is the combined age of the three oldest people? And we were racking our brains trying to get the exact number, and some of us were way off. Actually, we were all wrong. Dave, we were all wrong. The oldest person is still living. If you look at the story of Enoch, he never died. He is the first person to not die, first human, and he's still living. Therefore, by definition, he's still alive and much older than any of the ones that were even listed on the screen behind me. What is it about these two people, their lives, how they express their faith, that is a lesson to us? Why are they included in this Heroes of the Faith list? Clearly, that's what the author intends, is that their lives meant something for us or should mean something to us. So what is that? Well, let me read the text from Hebrews 11, and I appreciated Dave reading the Genesis account to kind of set a little bit of context, at least about the life of Enoch. This is what the Hebrews author says in Hebrews 11. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what is visible. By faith, Abel brought a better offering than his brother Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous. When God spoke well of his offerings, and by faith, Abel still speaks even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Let me suggest three things that the life of Abel and Enoch teach us about faith. First off, just a reminder of the definition. Steve gave a really good definition. Here's my definition of faith: a courageous confidence in God's promises that lead us to obedience. Or in other words, trusting the unseen. Often, sometimes we equate faith to intellectual assent, and Steve made that point quite well, that we just, if we believe something in our head, then that's faith. But I think a better word when we think about faith is the word trust. If I grab this chair here, and I look at this chair, and it looks like it's well-built. I could stand on it probably, and it looks that way. My belief that the chair is trustworthy, that I could stand on it and not fail, is that mental assent. Real faith, though, is to say, you know what? Let's get on this chair. The chair holds me up. That's faith. This is just looking at something. That's the difference. But here's the next step forward. Biblical faith is sometimes we don't even see the chair, but we're told about the chair. And we get to stand on something that is unseen. So the first thing I think that these men teach us is this idea to be sought. This is what Abel did, is he sought the Lord. Now, often when I read this account about Cain and Abel, and you know, both of them offer their offerings to God. One is an animal sacrifice, the other one is a grain offering. I always feel bad for Cain initially, because I'm like, what's wrong? He gave an offering too. Why does God accept one and not the other? What was wrong with Cain's offering? Because they both gave something to the Lord. Wasn't that what God asked us to do? But I think as we look at the text, both the Hebrews passage and the Genesis passage, there are some clues there that help us understand what the issue is. The issue was not so much the offering per se, but the motivation behind it. The issue wasn't one that was a sacrifice, as in blood sacrifice. The other one was a dry offering or grain offering. But the motivation, the heart, the seeking after, where one had trust in God and the other one was just going through the motions. And I think sometimes our faith can be like that, or our practice of faith can be like that, is that we go through the motions. We have that spiritual checklist that, okay, sang the song, did the prayer, listened to the message, said hello to a couple people, went home, check. But that our heart is not fully engaged in saying, I am here in the presence of the Holy God. And when I pray, prayer makes a difference. And when I am singing to the Lord God Almighty. Totally different than the checklist. I was confronted by this recently. As a pastor, I get the opportunity to have lots of prayer opportunity with many of you about all kinds of different things. And I had a friend of mine come to my office recently. And he shared his story, heartbreaking story. Loved one in the hospital, in a coma, came out of the coma, but still unresponsive, on life support. And this person was devastated. But really the devastation came from this. This person said, I wish I had one more chance to share Jesus with my wife. One more chance that she could hear God's love for her. And so he said, Cal, we need to pray. We need to pray that somehow God would wake her up. I understand that she will die. She will die soon. But can I have one more chance? And I think if any of us, as we heard the story, would be like the doctors, there's a sense of us wrestling with, that's a big ask. That's a big ask. Everyone is saying, probably not going to happen. It's amazing that she's still on life support. But I know that God expects of us to have big asks of him. And I wouldn't be much of a pastor if I just said no, and we're not going to pray. So we did. And we prayed expectantly. When I've been waiting to hear the news, and I had asked them, I said, when you hear something, let me know. This morning, he comes up to me and says, her eyes opened up. For how long? Who knows? But she can hear. She can hear. And she can hear the message of how much God loves her, how Jesus is really the only way. It's about seeking, not just a religious checklist. Sometimes, in one form or another, we could be like Cain, where We buy into this sense that it's about the doing the good things, about, well, if we're sincere and just do our best, that God will overlook all our faults, that he'll accept our good deeds and then let us into heaven. But the Bible is clear that by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified. Salvation by human goodness and works is impossible. Just to be a good person doesn't cut it in God's economy. Because none of us can be good enough. None of us can be righteous enough. In fact, God loves us before we've even tried. And so no kind of good human checklist counts. So in seeking God, how are we cultivating lifestyles and motivations that line up with those lifestyles, habits of growing deeper and seeking after God in different ways? Do we become hungry for pouring into reading his word? Do we become enraptured by having a chance to sing with other Christian brothers and sisters? Do we relish a time where we can just have that quiet time of praying to God, us and him? How do we seek him? Without an act of faith, it is impossible, Scripture says, to see God. It is impossible to please God. In your offerings, in your spiritual practices, in your prayers, your commitments, your possessions, your friendships, your job, your family, how are you seeking God? How are you putting your trust in him? The second thing is walk. We see this in Enoch especially. The text says that he walked with God. Now, if you know my wife, one of her love languages is going for walks. Probably one of her happiest places is a walk in a forested path. Just being out in nature, outside, and walking. If I want to be a good husband and start to hear her heart and grow close to her, when she asks to go for a walk, I need to say yes. Those are opportunities. It's kind of like that with God too. God invites us regularly to walk with him. What happens when we walk with someone? Imagine that you're walking with someone, and this close friend that you're enjoying this walk with down this forested trail. You're in close proximity with that person, side by side. What do? Well, you talk a bit. You laugh. You listen. You share your heart. Your attention is focused on that person more than anything else around you. And if you do notice something, you should talk about it and you share, hey, look, check out that deer running across the field. You're in harmony and you both enjoy the camaraderie. Walking with God is kind of like that. That when we enter into an intimate heart relationship with God through the faith in his son, he becomes our heart's greatest desire. Knowing him and hearing his voice, sharing our hearts with him, seeking to please him, are all these activities of walking with God. And I love this idea that the Bible uses descriptions of God going before us and behind us. But in this case, I love the intimacy that walking alongside describes. Shoulder to shoulder. He becomes everything to us. That meeting with him doesn't have to happen on a Sunday morning, but that we look forward to it when we get up out of bed in the morning, before our eyes close into sleep, during the day, before work, during work and after work, during an exam at school and afterwards. A.W. Tozer states that the goal of every Christian should be to live in a state of unbroken worship. It's another visual of this idea of walking with God. When the Bible talks about walking with God, it talks about this lifestyle that we have. Reminds us that we can't just walk with God and also walk in the ways of the world at the same time. Sometimes in the New Testament, walking with God is described as walking in the Spirit. Walking with God means that we choose to glorify Him in every way we can, regardless of even the personal costs. We say we want to head in the same direction. We have those shared beliefs and values, we say. That we get to be honest with God. I dare say even sometimes disagree with God when we're walking with Him. I think He's big enough to handle that. But in that relationship of disagreement, as we walk with Him, we begin to understand, okay, yeah, that's right, your way was the right way. I see now your insight into that situation, Lord. When we walk with God, we choose the narrow road, the narrow pathway over the broad way that leads to destruction. We seek to eliminate from our lives everything that does not enhance our walk with Him. We begin to apply 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31, that says, so whenever you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it for the glory of God. Micah 6:8 talks about one of our chief aims is to walk humbly with our God. Without an act of faith, it is impossible to see God. It is impossible to please God. So what does walking with God look like in your own life? Do you take time to answer the invitation to go for a walk, or do you stay home? Do you regularly picture God with you? Or sometimes you prefer, if you're walking with God, that at one point, God, can you just kind of step over a little bit and turn around for a few minutes? Walking with the Lord. This third one, the last one that I wanted to highlight, is trusted. These men, they trusted God. This kind of conviction, deep conviction that is lived out. There's an ad, I like watching trailers, and just recently, a movie, it's based on an old franchise, is getting a reboot. Indiana Jones is coming out in, I believe, June. And I was watching this trailer, and I was listening to Harrison Ford do a little narration here. I don't know if you can read the text behind me there that gives us a little narration, but this is what Harrison Ford says as Indiana Jones. I don't believe in magic, but a few times in my life, I've seen things. Things I can't explain. And I've come to believe that it's not so much what you believe, but how hard you believe it. And I remember listening to that going, that is hogwash. That is so anti-God-like. When we trust God, it's not just about having trust. It's about who we are trusting that matters. Why we are trusting in who we trust that matters. Not just having more trust. Not just having more faith for the sake of faith. It's easy for the world to say that, because it sounds nice, you put it on a card, makes everyone feel good, but it's a lie from Satan. The other thing when we talk about trust is that we're not to hedge our bets. We had a pastor here years ago, his name was Ken Law. He had given up his job at Husky as an executive and became full-time pastor and joined us. And under his leadership and his leadership team, Bow Valley actually became one of the largest, or the largest Chinese churches in Calgary, which is fascinating to see. And the one thing that we talked about when we talked to Ken Law is we joked, we said, every time someone goes into your office, Ken, they come out a Christian. And it was amazing. He baptized, and in his ministry baptized so many people. Well, one time he told me, he said, Cal, you know, it's tricky. I have these conversations with people, and I have to discern why they're putting their trust in Jesus. Because sometimes they're just kind of hedging their bets. Because they say to me, well, I believe in Buddha. So I've got a bit of Buddhism to cover that base in case Buddhism is right. And, you know, I'll dabble in a little bit of Shintoism or maybe Hinduism just to make sure if some of that stuff is right. Make sure that reincarnation, if it's real, then I'll get reincarnated in a better place. And then, you know, I want to add Jesus to the mix just in case Jesus is right. That's not trust. That's hedging our bets. But keep in mind that trust still asks questions. To have faith still means you can ask questions, to wrestle with doubts. But here's the difference between just wrestling with doubts, because if you just ask questions, if you just wrestle with doubts, you'll become a cynic. And that will destroy any sense of relationship you'll have with God. So if you have questions, the next step is you got to seek the answers. If you have doubts, you got to figure out, okay, is this a legitimate doubt or not? I can't just let it sit there, because if you just let it sit there, it will corrupt your soul. The danger with deconstructionism, and I know it's a popular thing right now, is that deconstructionism stops at deconstruction. If you don't know what deconstructionism, it's kind of it's been around for a long time. Basically, it's taking what you believe and breaking it down, tearing apart any sort of things that maybe aren't legitimate, aren't real, aren't true. The problem is that too many people who are deconstructing their faith right now are just tearing it down, and it's just a pile of rubble on the floor. And then they stop and they go, huh, I guess it wasn't anything. But what God is inviting us all to do is not just to deconstruct our faith and make it stronger, but to rebuild it on truth. When I went to Bible college, the way I describe my Bible college experiences, I had 4 years of them building a foundation. So I learned about the faith, I learned about different arguments, I learned about, you know, how we got the Bible and the reasons to believe in the resurrection, etc. It was building up. Then I went on to seminary. And seminary can be either 2 years or 3 years. I took three because I'm not that smart. And so the first year of seminary, they basically say it's a deconstruction of your faith. We're going to tear down all those things that you think you believe. And some of my friends after the first year walked away from not just seminary, not just the pastoral ministry, but from their faith completely. It was so sad. Because if you stick around for the second and the third year, they start to give you tools to rebuild something that's stronger and deeper and more real. And I hope in our churches that that's what we can do. So if you are wrestling with something, don't just wrestle with it and let it lead you towards cynicism. But seek out the answers. Seek people that might have the answers, or at least point you in the right directions. I love the way Helen Keller, who was blind and deaf at the same time, described trust. She said, "I can see, and that is why I can be happy. In what you call the dark, but to me, it is golden. I can see a God-made world, not the man-made world that most of you see." Faith is seeing the unseen. That is God's version of reality. Without an act of faith, it is impossible to see God. Without an act of faith, it is impossible to please God. So what does trust look like in your life? When life doesn't measure up to your expectations, do you still trust God? When life knocks you to the ground, leaving you with a wound or a limp, can you still trust? I read a book last night about this woman who, she was a Christian speaker on the travel circuit, sharing her faith to thousands of women. Her and her husband were doing ministry together, active, vibrant ministry. Had a son, smart guy in the Christian club, a leader in school, valedictorian, went off to become a naval officer, did really well. And then she gets a phone call one day. And she said, "The worst news I've ever heard in my life. I'm told by the person on the other line that my son is arrested for first-degree murder." Her son had just married 13 months ago this beautiful woman and had two young daughters. So this new marriage, he had just graduated to be an officer, and now he's arrested with witnesses. First-degree cold-blooded murder. She said that news rocked her world. She couldn't understand why and how, and all her dreams with her only son became shattered. She was in shock. And the book goes on about what it's like to live through that journey and visiting her son in the prison. And in Florida, where he was arrested, they practiced the death penalty for first-degree murder. And so that was on her mind too. She said, "How could this happen? He loved God. He served in the church. He loved his wife. How could he do that?" So she began this journey of deeper trust in God. And what's beautiful about the book is that it's very real, that in some ways, not a happy ending. Her son isn't released. He's in jail, stays in jail. But she said her faith became real, that in spite of the woundedness, the brokenness, the disappointment, she still knew that God was good, that God loved her son and God loved her. What does it mean to trust God? Sometimes a common response for some of us is, "I'm no hero. You're talking about these heroes of the faith, but I'm no hero." But in spite of our mistakes, our lack of power, or knowledge, or charm, or wisdom, God takes our bumbling through today and says, "That's enough. If you keep trusting in me, a bumbling forward, being courageous one step at a time, that's enough." Sometimes our response is, "Should I follow him blindly?" Blind faith. And I think we need to look at the Bible and realize that when the Bible talks about signs and wonders, what is a sign, a miraculous thing? It's pointing to something. It's basically saying this happened, which should lead us to a natural conclusion that this is real, that this that is unseen is real. When Jesus is crucified, that's a fact. He is killed by a professional. He is buried. The sign is that he's resurrected and walks amongst people, where people can touch his wounds and see the scars. Those are signs to point to what? That he is God, that he has power over sin and death. So we do not have to follow God blindly, that God has given us evidence, and that we're to take that evidence and take it to its logical conclusion. So I believe we're asked to have an informed faith. And I think that's what Abel would have done, and that's what Enoch would have done. But sometimes this last question is, do I have enough to trust him? Do I have enough knowledge, enough understanding, enough capacity? And I want to say, it's interesting that we read about Abel and Enoch before, long before the Old Testament covenant shows up, before the law of Moses shows up, before the system of worship shows up. Right at the very beginning, God says they had enough. In spite of living in a world where, especially Enoch, where it was full of sin and rebellion, he had enough that he could be considered righteous by his motivation in walking with God. And I want to say, you here have enough. God has given you enough. If you don't come to God in faith, you will not please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. The most absolute and basic principles of faith are here: to believe that God is your creator, your giver, your provider, your Messiah, your Savior, but also to believe that God is a rewarder for those who seek him. Keep your eye on the proper reward. The reward is not an ease of life. The reward is not some sort of temporary payoff. The reward of faith is that God is pleased and that he declares you as righteous. And this righteousness will allow you to live forever with God. He's asking you to trust in that reward and to say and believe that it is worth it. The writer here is not telling these suffering Hebrews that they need to rise up and claim victory or to believe that God will deliver them from their peril. He is telling them that in the middle of their peril, when it feels like God is absent or silent, that he is still there and that we need to trust him and that it is worth it. Sweeping across Germany at the end of World War II, Allied forces were searching for snipers in from farms and house to house. One abandoned house, they went in, and with flashlights, they made their way even down to this basement that was pretty much just a heap of rubble. There on a crumbling wall, they saw scratched in there the Star of David. And beneath it, this rough lettering that said, "I believe in the sun, even when it doesn't shine. I believe in love, even when it is not shown. And I believe in God, even when he doesn't speak." But Jesus has spoken. And Jesus is inviting all of us. If you're here this morning, and maybe you've never fully trusted in God, I made that step of saying, I want to mark for certainty of saying, I am following God with all my heart. And you do that as he prescribed and through baptism, of being underwater and coming back out, of turning your life from your own way to his way. He's inviting you. Jesus is speaking. And maybe you are here and that you have been baptized and you have committed your life, but it's been growing cold lately. That you've been going through the motions and doing the checklist. Jesus is inviting you for a walk. Come walk with me. Spend time with me. And I invite you not to do this privately if you want to respond to either of those two, but respond to God through someone. To talk to someone and say, I need help making this next step. Ultimately, Jesus is the example for us in all these things. For Jesus sought God. He sought God daily throughout the night and throughout the day. He did nothing on his own accord, but always in tandem and submission to the Father. He walked with God right up to the hill of Golgotha where he was crucified. And he trusted his Father with his life. Not a life of ease or free of pain, but trusted that God was good. And therefore we call Jesus the righteous one.